On October 29, 2007, more than 4,000 people crammed into Charlottesville's downtown pavilion to listen to Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama speak for about 45 minutes about why he's running for the nation's highest office. Virginia Governor Tim Kaine introduced the Illinois senator.
Hello, Charlottesville. Hello, Virginia. Are you ready to win this election for Barack Obama, our next president? Yeah. What a great night. Great night to come here. This is very uncharacteristic for me to be here tonight. I was one of Barack Obama's early supporters, but I've got another election in about a week that I'm really focused on. We have every legislator in Virginia is up a week from tomorrow. We've got a wonderful chance to take the Senate of Virginia for the first time in a long time.
But in terms of national figures, the person who probably was the most helpful to me was Senator Obama. In a wonderful way, came to the state on numerous occasions, and we got to know each other and really became friends. I learned three things about Barack Obama that we have in common. First, we both were graduates of Harvard Law School. Now, he was the president of the Harvard Law Review, and I was, you know, more toward the bottom of the class, but we were both there. We both married women from Harvard Law School, so you know we got that in common. All right, we were both civil rights lawyers. That was even better. That was my practice for 17 years. All right, and Barack was a community organizer and civil rights lawyer when he finished. But the most important thing was this: both of our mothers were raised in the same tiny farm town in western Kansas, El Dorado, Kansas. And their parents even kind of vaguely knew one another, so we're probably cousins or something. Not to bring up that other cousin that has been much in the news. But that was the start of a friendship, and it was so easy for me when the senator was thinking about jumping in the presidential race about a year ago. I was so excited about that. He called and we talked about it. Out and touching base with supporters all over the nation, and I was flattered that he would ask my opinion, but I said I hoped he would run. I hoped he would run, and we talked about it. I said, look, if you do run, you know it'll be tough. You will be the underdog, but you've been the underdog before. You know what it's like to be the underdog. You've got to be disciplined and smart and keep up your optimism and hope, but underdogs win races. I've run many races. I've never been the favorite in any race that I've won, but I've never lost a race because I know what happens when you're the underdog. You work harder and you work smarter and you're hungrier. And I could tell that Senator Obama was the kind of person that Virginians and Americans would gravitate to in a wonderful way. So I encouraged him to run, and I was so excited when he announced. And then I became the first governor outside of his home state to endorse his candidacy. I'm one of the national co-chairs of his campaign, and very, very proud of him. I am confident in the work that I've done for the Senate. I am confident that he could get Virginia's electoral votes in the Democratic column for the first time since 1964. He's that kind of a candidate. He's that kind of a candidate. As people get to know Barack Obama, what they know is this: first, he stands for excellence. And America's ready for excellence again in the White House. Excellence of education and intellect, excellence of character, excellence in surrounding himself with good people, and then even listening to them for, you know, what a novel idea. Excellence in recognizing that others are excellent too, and the way to be successful isn't to be go it your own way or be a, you know, lone ranger, but to gather the best around and then draw upon the best. That's the kind of excellence that Barack Obama has. And Americans are understanding that. With Barack Obama, you get, in addition, a real passion about solutions, not the rhetoric, not the divisive stuff. He's not going to run and win a campaign by figuring out the way to beat up 45% of the population so that 55% will support him. No, he is by nature and by character, bringing people together. He's done it throughout his career. as an organizer, as a state legislator, as a U.S. senator. And that's what this nation needs, somebody who will truly bring this nation together. And Barack has a unique ability to do that, and that's why he's going to be such a great president. Barack Obama has a unique ability to send a message to the rest of the world that America is once again ready to re-engage and be powerful because of the power of our example. Our nation has succeeded best when we've acted in ways that have made other nations want to emulate us, not with a fist always, but with a hand of friendship extended. Barack Obama's election will send an immediate signal to the rest of the world that here is a leader of strength, but also of sufficient wisdom to understand that we'll all be safer and we'll all live in a better world if we extend that hand to the rest of the world. And that's the kind of president that Barack Obama will be. And so, as you can see, it was easy for me to get on board, and we are now entering the last 8 weeks before the first primary. You probably saw the caucus in Iowa has now moved up to the 3rd of January, just a couple of days after New Year. I'm going to be out in Iowa in the middle weekend of Iowa, of November. I'm going to be out in Iowa the weekend before Christmas. So many from around this nation are gathering. The field team that Senator Obama has in Iowa is second to none. My friends in Iowa have called me and told me, you would not believe the strength of this team. At the end of the day, that's what really matters, the connections you have with people on the ground. It's not all about TV ads. It's not all about money in the bank. The senator's got money in the bank, and that's great. But what it's really about is how excited people feel at the ground level. And the reports that I'm getting from Iowa is folks are very excited because they recognize that Senator Obama is the one candidate who can most create, lead to, and inspire positive change in this nation, and we need positive change. Virginians, great Charlottesville residents, folks are here not just from Charlottesville, but from all over the Commonwealth, Richmond, Hampton Roads, Northern Virginia. Yeah, oh man, we're from everywhere. But you're all here for the same reason. You're all here because, like me, you've gotten on board. You believe that Barack Obama offers the best hope for this nation. So give a very, very warm Virginia welcome to the next president of the United States, Senator Barack Obama. All right.
Thank you, Virginia. Thank you. Thank you so much. Wow. Look at this. Look at this crowd. Look at this crowd. I'm ready for the general election. Let's go win Virginia. Let's go win Virginia. Man, look at this. What an unbelievable crowd. Thank you so much, everybody. Thank you. Now, before we do anything, I just want to congratulate the Commonwealth for its infinite wisdom in electing Tim Kaine as governor. I am proud to have his support. I am proud to have his endorsement. I am proud that he is my friend and advisor. He is somebody who, the moment you meet him, right away you can tell this is a decent man, a hard-working man, somebody who's in it for the right reasons. And so we are so proud of him, and I am very grateful for his friendship. Thank you. Thank you. I love you back. I love you. I also want to thank John Dearth and his friends for the musical programming. They were terrific. Thank you. Thank you. To all the folks who are here, everybody who got here early, Everybody, what time do you guys get here? 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock, that's what I'm talking, 4:30? Okay. I appreciate you. Whose birthday is it? Tony. Happy birthday, Tony. Give it up for Tony. All right. Well, listen. I have been traveling all across the country now for over 9 months as a candidate for President of the United States. And, you know, everywhere we go, we've been seeing these wonderful crowds like this. You know, we had 10,000 people in Iowa City, Iowa. We had 20,000 in Austin, Texas, and 15,000 in Oakland, California, and 25,000 people in New York City. And what's inspiring about a crowd like this is not just its size, although that's pretty inspiring, I got to say, but it's the makeup of the crowd. Look around. You see a cross-section of America. You see young people and you see old people. You see blacks, whites, Hispanics, Asians, Native Americans. You see people with disabilities. You see gay folks and straight folks. And you see Democrats and independents. And yes, you even see some Republicans out here. I know the Republicans because when I'm shaking hands afterwards, they whisper to me. They say, Barack, I'm a Republican, but I support you. I say, thank you, but why are we whispering? You can come out. It's okay. We got a lot of Republicans for Obama. Now, part of the reason people are coming out in record numbers, and part of the reason that you're here tonight is, let's face it, you are sick and tired of George W. Bush. Let's admit it. You are tired of an administration that treats our Constitution as a nuisance to be avoided, as opposed to the foundation of our liberty and the foundation of our democracy. You're tired of that. You're tired of administration policies that seem to widen the gulf between rich and poor, that seem to always favor the wealthy and the powerful, while ordinary people are struggling to fill up the gas tank or save for their child's college education or save for their own retirement. You are tired of the lack of progress on critical issues like health care and energy and education. You have memories of 2 years ago when we saw our fellow citizens standing on rooftops after a storm without water and without food because an administration was either too indifferent or too incompetent to execute a rescue. And most of all, you are tired of a war that should have never been authorized and should have never been waged, that has cost us billions of dollars and thousands of lives and has not made us more safe, but has fundamentally diminished our standing in the world. You're tired of the war. You want to get our troops home. So you got good reason to want to be engaged and involved in this campaign, because a lot is at stake, and we've seen enormous damage done over the last 7 years. But, you know, people, I think, are coming out, and you're here tonight, because you don't want to just be against something. You also want to be for something. You also want to have a sense. You also want to believe that America is not just a collection of red states and blue states, that we are not inevitably bound up in this partisan, petty, trivialized politics, that it's still possible for us to rally together as Americans, to rally around a common purpose, to rally around a common destiny. And it is because I believe in that common purpose and that common destiny that I am running for the presidency of the United States of America. Now, in order to achieve that vision of common purpose, it is going to require that we do more than just change political parties in the White House. Change begins by George Bush going back to Crawford, but he is not on the ballot. He's not on the ballot in 2009. What is it? Thank God. But he's not on the ballot in 2009. If we're going to bring about change, big change, not incremental change, not around the edges nibbling change, but big change, real change, we are also going to have to change our politics. We're going to have to change how business is done in Washington. And if you doubt this, think about it. Think about some of the biggest challenges we face. We have been talking about health care reform for decades now, through Democratic and Republican administrations. And yet year after year after year, the only thing that changes is that more people join the ranks of the uninsured, and those people who have health insurance are seeing their co-payments and deductibles and premiums going up. Now, why is that? Well, part of it has to do with the fact that we've got drug companies and insurance companies that have spent $1 billion over the last decade preventing reform from happening. And so if we think that somehow just electing a president without changing how politics is done in Washington is going to bring about the kind of health care reform that the American people are dying for, in some cases literally, then you've got another thing coming. We've got to change our politics. We've got to change our politics. The same is true when it comes to energy. We've been talking about energy independence for decades now. Yeah, I went back and I looked at some of the clips since Richard Nixon, Tim. Every year, year after year, at the State of the Union address, some president will intone, you know, we have to free ourselves from dependence on foreign oil, blah, blah, blah. And yet, every year, nothing happens. Why is that? Now, it doesn't help when you put my cousin Dick Cheney in charge of energy policy. That doesn't help. We've been trying to hide that for a long time. You know, everybody's got a black sheep in the family. But, you know, when Dick Cheney was in charge of energy policy, he met with the environmental groups once, he met with the renewable energy groups once, and then he met with the oil and gas companies 40 times. So it's not surprising then that our energy policy has been very good for ExxonMobil, but it hasn't been very good for you. So understand what I'm saying here. Understand what I'm saying here, because there are some people in this campaign who are saying, elect me because I know how to work the system. The system hasn't been working for us. There are those who claim, elect me because I know how to play the game better. Understand, we don't need somebody who knows how to play the game better. We need somebody who's going to put an end to the game playing, because the times are too serious and the stakes are too high. And that's why I'm running for president of the United States of America, to put an end to the game playing. It's easier to understand what I'm talking about when you get outside of Washington. You know, one of the best days I've had in this campaign so far, I went out to Oakland, California, because the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, had organized all the presidential candidates to walk in the shoes of one of their members for a day. And so I went out to Oakland, and I woke up at 5 in the morning, and I went to the home of a 61-year-old home care worker named Pauline Beck. And when I got there, she was already up fixing breakfast for two foster children who don't have a family of their own and that she's taken care of, that she's taken in. And then we went over to the home of an 86-year-old amputee named John Thornton, who Miss Beck cares for every single day. He couldn't stay in his home if it wasn't for her. And so that morning, we did what Ms. Beck usually does. We helped him out of bed, helped him with his prosthetic leg, helped him put on his clothes, took off the soiled sheets and did the laundry and fixed him breakfast and scrubbed the floors. My wife, when she heard about this, she couldn't believe it. She said, I want to see the videotape. But listening to this humble woman talk about the hardships of her life, without a trace of self-pity, just glad to be of some service to somebody, just hoping that maybe she could get a little more pay to take care of those kids, just hoping that maybe she could have a little more security in her retirement, just hoping maybe, just maybe, she could get a day off once in a while to rest some tired feet or a weary back. I was reminded about why I became a community organizer over two decades ago to work with steel workers who had lost their jobs from the steel plants that had closed down in Chicago, because there are people like Pauline Beck all across the country. There are millions of people all across Virginia just like her, working hard every single day, doing the right thing by their families, doing the right thing in their communities. They are working hard and they are struggling. They haven't seen their wages go up. They haven't seen their incomes go up while all their costs are going up. They're seeing their sons and daughters being sent to Iraq for one or two or three tours and then not having the services that they need to readjust when they come home. They are struggling to see if maybe if I get sick, we may be bankrupt. They're trying to figure out, how do I save for college education for my kid and my own retirement at the same time? Every single day they are working hard. And they don't feel like anybody's listening to them in Washington. There is a core decency to the American people, a generosity of spirit to the American people that is just waiting to be tapped. They don't expect government to solve all their problems. They know they've got to work hard to make it on their own, but what they do expect is, what you expect is that if you are able and willing to work, you should be able to find a job that pays a living wage. That you shouldn't be bankrupt when you get sick. That every child should have a decent education. That every child should be able to go to college. That you should be able to retire with some dignity and some respect. And they don't expect government to do everything, but they expect maybe government can help a little bit. Just a little bit of help. And it's to tap that decency and that generosity of spirit that's going to be the challenge of this next campaign. And that's the reason I'm running for President of the United States of America, because I have faith in the American people. They are looking for something new. They are ready to turn the page and write a new chapter in American history. But they want somebody in Washington who's going to listen to them, who's going to fight for them, who's going to be paying attention to their struggles. Now, when I talk this way, sometimes the folks in Washington, they say, oh, Obama's talking about hope again. He's so naive. He's a hope peddler. He's a hope monger. That's all right. I stand guilty as charged. I am hopeful about America's future. In fact, I've noticed that the folks in Washington, they ascribe my hopefulness to not having been there long enough. You know, they think, oh, that's a sign of lack of experience. He needs to be in Washington longer. We need to stew him more and season him a little bit and boil that hope out of him so he can start thinking like we do. Start believing you can't change the system. Whenever I hear this talk about experience, I'm amused. First of all, I got 2 decades of experience as a community organizer, as a civil rights attorney, as a constitutional law professor, as a state legislator, as a United States senator. But I also have to point out, there are a couple of guys named Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld who had 2 of the longest resumes in Washington, and they led us into the worst foreign policy disaster in a generation. So a long resume says nothing about your character. A long resume says nothing about your judgment. And the next presidents is all going to be about judgment, and it's going to be all about character. It's going to be about who can make the kinds of decisions that include all Americans within the American dream. Who can make decisions that will repair the damage that's been done around the world? Who's got the character to work with the American people around the major challenges that we face with courage and conviction? So when I talk about my experience, I talk about the experience I have of bringing people together to get things done. Of getting Republicans and Democrats in Illinois to work together to give thousands of people who didn't have health insurance. To get Republicans and Democrats together in Washington to agree to arms control legislation or to help broker a deal to maybe increase fuel efficiency standards in cars. That's the kind of experience, the kind of judgment and character that the next president will need. When I talk about my experience, I talk about the willingness to take on the special interests and win. Like I've done at the state level, getting money out of politics. At the federal level, making sure that we pass the toughest ethics reform legislation since Watergate, working with Russ Feingold so that lobbyists couldn't keep on giving free gifts and meals and lending corporate jets to members of Congress, because Congress should be accountable to you, not accountable to lobbyists. I think that's relevant to who's going to be the next president. How have they fought those battles? I think the next president is going to have to be able to stand up, even when it's not popular. It's like I did in 2002 when the drums of war were beating. And George Bush's popularity was at 65-70%. And 10 days before the vote to authorize the war in Iraq, I was invited to an anti-war rally in Chicago. And I was in the middle of a U.S. Senate race, so my friends pulled me aside. They said, no. Bush is popular. The war is popular. If you go out there and then the war goes well, you may be throwing away this U.S. Senate race. You may be hurting your political career. I said, listen, I do not intend to begin my career as a United States senator by backing down on what I believe in. And so I went to that rally and I spoke out against that war. And that's the kind of experience that I bring to bear in this race for the White House. So I may not have the experience Washington likes, but I've got the experience America needs right here and right now to lead this country in a new direction. That's why I'm running for president. Now, there's another quality that the next president needs, and that is some righteous anger, a sense of impatience. I am angry that we have, in the wealthiest nation on earth, 47 million people without health insurance, and millions more who are just barely hanging on. I know something about this. I know something about this. My mother died of cancer when she was 53 years old. And I remember in the waning days of her life, in those last few months, she wasn't spending time thinking about how to get well. She wasn't taking stock of her own mortality. She was reading through the insurance forms because she had gotten sick just as she was taking a new job. And the insurance companies were saying, well, maybe this was a pre-existing condition and we're not going to pay your medical bills. I was furious. And I remember thinking, even back then, this is wrong. This isn't how things should work in America. And that's why, as President of the United States, I'm going to make sure that every single person has health care that is as good as mine as a member of Congress. And we are going to put money in prevention so that people are getting regular checkups instead of going to the emergency room. And we're going to lower premiums by working with insurance companies to do the right thing and employers to do the right thing. And we are not going to have this waiting until 20 years from now or 10 years from now. We are going to do it by the end of my first term as President of the United States of America. The time for waiting is over. I don't accept that we can't provide a world-class education to every American child. That means more than slogans. Don't pass No Child Left Behind and then leave the money behind for No Child Left Behind. We know what to do. We know what to do. We know that if we invest in early childhood education and get every child prepared for school that first day, we couldn't make a better investment in our children's learning. We can close the achievement gap between black and brown and white kids in this society and have them all succeed. We know what to do if we recruit an army of new teachers. As the baby boom generation is retiring, we've got to pay them more money and give them more training and work with them and not against them to raise standards in the schools. We know what to do. And I don't know about you, I think it's about time that maybe we made college affordable and accessible to every single American. We can afford to do that. Get the banks out. Get the financial institutions out. They don't need to be middlemen. Take those billions of dollars, give more grants, lower interest rates, set up national service opportunities. Young people want to serve America. Give them a chance to work off their debt. We know what to do. I don't accept that the American dream is a thing of the past. It's a thing of the future. That's why we've got to make work pay. We've got to increase the minimum wage, not every 10 years, but every year. Make it a livable wage. We've got to give unions the power to lift workers up into the middle class. We've got to invest in our infrastructure in this country. Instead of spending $10, $12 billion every month in Iraq, we could be investing right here in America in building roads and bridges and hospitals and schools and putting people back to work. And we can stop with these corporate tax loopholes that are set up, giving tax breaks, to companies that are moving jobs overseas or setting up tax havens overseas. Let's save those tax breaks for companies that are investing right here in the United States of America. That's what I want to do as president. I don't accept that we have to keep on sending $800 million a day to hostile nations, fueling terrorism, melting the polar ice caps. We know what to do. If we increased fuel efficiency standards on cars to 40 miles per gallon, we would save the equivalent of all the oil we import from the Persian Gulf. Imagine what that would do for our economy, what it would do for our environment, what it would do for our national security. And by the way, when I made this proposal, I didn't do it in front of environmental groups in California. I went to Detroit in front of the automakers. Except, I have to say, the room was really quiet, Tim. Nobody clapped. But that's okay, because part of what you should want from the next president is not just somebody who's going to tell you what they think you want to hear, but is going to tell you what you need to hear. Is going to tell you the truth. That's the least you can expect from the President of the United States of America. Most of all, I do not accept that there is a contradiction between our national security and our standing in the world. Those things aren't contradictory, they are complementary. We need to bring an end to this war. We have to recognize that there are no military solutions to be had in Iraq, that there will only be political solutions grounded in hard work and diplomacy. And we need to start bringing our troops home now. And we need a Congress that will stand up to George Bush and get him to change course. But I guarantee you this, Virginia, if we have not started bringing our troops home by the time I am sworn in as President of the United States of America, I will call in the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It will be the first thing I do. They will have a new mission, and that is to start bringing our boys and girls home. But understand this, it is not enough just to bring this war to a close if we want to repair the damage that's been done around the world. We have to change the mindset that got us into the war in the first place. We have to break the fever of fear that has come to dominate our politics. We need to rediscover diplomacy. Real diplomacy. Direct diplomacy. I got in an argument with Senator Clinton about this. I said, yes, I would meet with any world leader. And they said, I was told, no, that's naive, that's irresponsible. I was told, oh, no. You know, you could lose a propaganda battle with these folks. I'm not afraid of losing a propaganda battle with some petty dictator? I fear no man. America fears no country. But strong countries and strong presidents meet with their adversaries and tell them where America stands and what we believe in and what we'll fight for. We have confidence about who we are. I'm tired of a fearful America. I want a courageous America. I want an America that knows what it's about, understands its roots in liberty and democracy and rule of law. I want to go before the United Nations as the next president of the United States and say, America is back. And America's ready to lead. But we're not just going to lead. Yes, we are going to lead militarily. We will get off the wrong battlefield in Iraq, and we will go out after Al-Qaeda. We will take out those who will kill us. Yes, we are going to lock down loose nuclear weapons that could fall into the hands of terrorists and cause a threat to all of humanity. But we are also going to work with other nations to build schools around the world that can teach math and science instead of hatred of America. We're also going to work with other countries to deal with HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa because it's the right thing to do. But because diseases can start over there and end up over here real quick, we want to bring an end to the genocide in Darfur because we are not a nation that turns a blind eye to slaughter. And while we're at it, we are going to close Guantanamo and we're going to restore habeas corpus because we are not a nation that locks people up without charging them. We are not a nation that ships people off in the dead of night to be tortured in other countries. That's not who we are. We are the United States of America, a bright and shining light. The last best hope on earth, if we can break out of this fear. Tired of being governed by fear. I want to take on whoever the Republican nominee is. You hear him talking right now, oh, we need to double the size of Guantanamo. We need to bomb Iran. We need to do this. I want to have that argument before the American people. I want to have an argument about civil liberties. Let me tell you one of the first things I will do. I will call in my attorney general and I will say we are going to go through every executive order that George Bush has issued and we are going to reverse those that are encroaching on our civil liberties. No more warrantless wiretaps. No more sneaking around the FISA court. No more politics of fear. We're going to break the fever. We're going to have a politics of hope. But here's the thing, Virginia. I can't do it by myself. I can't do it by myself. I am reminded every day of my life, if not by events, then by my wife, that I am not a perfect man. And I will not be a perfect president. But I can promise you this. I will always tell you what I think. I will always tell you where I stand. I will be honest with you about the challenges that we face as a country because some of them are going to be hard. And we are going to have to rise up to the occasion. We're going to have courage and conviction to meet those challenges, but we can do it. And I'll tell you when it's going to be hard. I will listen to you even when we disagree. Because this is a big, diverse country. And we're not always going to agree on everything. But we can disagree without being disagreeable. We can listen to each other. And most importantly, I will wake up every single day thinking about, how can I make your lives a little bit better? How can I fight for a little more justice in this country? How can I fight for a little more opportunity in this country? How can we create a little more upward mobility in this country? How can we create a broader arena of civil liberties in this country? How can we make America safer? I will be spending every waking hour thinking about you. And in exchange, what I need you to do is understand that when I open up the doors of government back to the American people, that you're willing to walk through it. Now, if you just leave this rally saying, oh, that was a nice rally, then I haven't done my job. You've got an election next week that will help determine whether Tim Kaine can move his agenda through here in Virginia. You've got to turn out and vote next week. I need you to be involved in this campaign for change. I need you to volunteer and knock on doors and make phone calls and travel to Iowa for me and sign up other students. And in other words, I am not just asking you to trust in my ability to lead this country. I'm confident about my capacity to lead. I wouldn't be running if I didn't believe that I was the best qualified candidate to become president. But I'm not just asking you to trust in my ability to lead this country. I'm asking you to trust in yourselves, to believe in us, to believe in the power of all these voices here. Because change in America does not happen from the top down. It happens from the bottom up. It happens because millions of voices rally for change. Millions of voices join together to say, we're going to end slavery. We're going to end Jim Crow. We're going to give women the right to vote. We're going to end the Vietnam War. We're going to start an environmental movement. We're going to end the Iraq War. That's how change happens. So, if any of you doubt the power of your voice, let me just close by telling you a quick story about a trip I took to South Carolina, an early state. This several months ago, I went down there for a legislative banquet. I was the keynote speaker. I was sitting next to a state representative there. I decided I needed the state rep's endorsement. I said, "State representative, I need your endorsement." She looked at me. She said, "Obama, I will give you my endorsement if you come to my hometown of Greenwood, South Carolina." So I must have had a glass of wine or something, because right off the bat I said, "Okay, I'm coming." Only to find out later that Greenwood is an hour and a half from every place else. So the next time we fly into Greenwood, fly into South Carolina, I think we fly into Greenville, it's late. It's about midnight when we land at the airport. I've been campaigning for 2 weeks. I'm exhausted. My throat is sore. I'm maybe getting a cold. I get to the hotel room about 12:30, and I'm staggering into my room, just looking forward to that pillow. And my staff taps me on the shoulder and says, Senator. I said, "What?" He said, "You have to be in the car at 6 a.m. tomorrow morning." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "Because we've got to go to Greenwood like you promised." So the next morning I wake up and I am feeling just rotten, just feeling terrible. And I stagger out of bed and I go pull the drapes open in the hotel room, and it's pouring outside. Miserable day. Go get some coffee, open up the New York Times. There's a bad story about me in the New York Times. Pack up, go downstairs. My umbrella blows open and I get poured, soaked, rained on. Drenched. So now I'm in the car. I'm sleepy. I'm wet, and I'm mad. And we start driving out to Greenwood. We drive and we drive and we drive. Finally, we get to Greenwood. Although you don't know you're in Greenwood right away, because there are no tall buildings in Greenwood. There's some fields and woods, and then there's like some parks, and then we pull up to a little field house, and I go inside the field house, my staff and I, and lo and behold, after driving for an hour and a half, there are only 20 people there. 20 people. And they all look like they might have gotten rained on that morning, and they're looking not that happy. But, you know, we've learned that every vote counts. So I've shaken hands saying, "How do you do? What do you do? How are things going? What's going on in Greenwood?" Suddenly, behind me, I hear this voice shout out, "Fired up!" And I startled just like you. I didn't know what to do. But the other 20 people from Greenwood, they all just act like this is normal. They say, "Fired up." Then we hear this voice say, "Ready to go!" and the other 20 people say, ready to go. And I don't know what's going on. I look back, and there's this little woman. She's about 65 years old, about 5'2", 5'3". She's got a sort of an outfit on, got a big church hat, glasses. She looks right at me, and she smiles. She says, fired up! Come to find out, this woman is a city councilwoman from Greenwood who is famous for her chant. She's been doing this for years now. They call her the chant lady. And she's very proud of it. She chants everywhere she goes at various events. And so for the next 5 minutes, she proceeds to just keep on chanting. And I don't really know what to do. I thought I'd be the star attraction. I'm, you know, presidential candidate coming to Greenwood. But no, everybody's chanting. And so I'm standing there. I look at my staff. They shrug their shoulders. But here's the thing, Virginia. After about a minute or two, I'm feeling kind of fired up. I feel like I'm ready to go. So I join in the chant, and it feels kind of good. And even for the rest of the day, even after we left Greenwood, every time I saw my staff, I said, are you fired up? They said, I'm fired up, boss. You ready to go? I said, I'm ready to go. So it goes to show you how one voice can change a room. And if one voice can change a room, it can change a city. And if it can change a city, it can change a state. If it can change a state, it can change a nation. If it can change a nation, it can change the world. So I only want to know one thing, Virginia. Are you fired up? Ready to go? Fired up? Ready to go? Fired up? Ready to go? Let's go change the world.